To those interested in lost civilizations, the channeled scablands here in Washington State need no introduction. Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson both have spoken about them at length, and if you're looking for evidence for a lost civilization destroying flood from around 12,000 years ago, that massive canyon and the associated coulees that cut through the middle of the state is a pretty good place to start. Of course, because of this, the most impressive features get spoken about the most, Dry Falls and the Finger Lakes and these huge mesas that the floodwaters left behind. But the smaller features also offer a lot of interesting things, not just to the people that are interested in the region or in the most specialized thing, but even to the lost civilization people, you'll find that I've got a little bit of evidence here for you that you're going to find pretty tantalizing. And the archaeologists out there that think that I'm just a horrible person, even you, by the end of this video, are going to have to say, well, Dan did good on this one over here. So let's talk about the Lake Lenoir Caves, sitting right there in the middle of the Scablands. Hi, my name is Dan, in case you didn't catch that a second ago, and welcome to Dedunking. Less than a 30-minute drive from Dry Falls, the Lake Lenoir Caves trailhead looks pretty desolate and uninviting. You'll see an outhouse and some like concrete stairs that go up the side of the place and a bunch of sagebrush and busted up chunks of basalt. And these are the only real clues that it's not just more of the same, those long stretches of what we call coulees around here. Not quite a cliff, it's like the side of a hill that's clearly part of the landscape that's been shaped by drainage. It would be very easy to just drive through this area and think there's nothing to see here, but of course, that would be a mistake. For instance, the first thing I noticed when ascending the trail were these hanging valleys clear across the canyon. They are so symmetrical and so neatly chopped off that I had to stop to just take it in. Some claim these to be the remnants of ripples, like a giant wave pattern left in the ground, but geologists believe that these are formed quite differently. These areas here, these were tributaries that fed into the river before the floodwaters just chopped the canyon and made everything completely different. When the floodwaters came through, the hills were cut down, leaving these tributaries to presumably become like waterfalls, right? These hanging valleys are pretty much a ubiquitous feature in the channeled scablands, but the ones that are visible from the Lake Lenoir Caves area are considered to be the most symmetrical looking in the entire Columbia Basin, which makes the view alone worth stopping to get out and climb a little bit. But when you stop and take in just how high above you the canyon goes and realize that this area was completely underwater, it is mind-boggling. You see the pictures and you see the videos, it's just insane. Now this is Lake Lenoir, right across the highway from the trailhead. It reaches 27 meters in depth at its deepest points. The coulees that tower above it and the hanging valleys, well, that's easily 300 feet above the river, 10 times as high as the river is deep, conservatively. This area was lush. It was green. Every one of those valleys in those hanging valleys was water that fed into a river. That was a tributary. So there was tons of water feeding into this river back 12,000 years ago or more. And so that's why they had all kinds of animals like giant sloths and freaking cave bears and scimitar cats, which are kind of like saber-toothed tigers, I guess. Or maybe it's the same thing and they've changed the name. I don't know. I didn't look too deep into that one. But then mastodons and mammoths and all kinds of shit. There was all kinds of stuff that lived here that was what they would call megafauna, which is stuff that's around 100 pounds or more, for those of you who don't know. And all that stuff's gone now. But those coulees, those hanging valleys at the top of the coulees, they show these tributaries where they used to come in. So it's kind of a stark reminder of just how green the region is. When you look up and realize each one of those was water that fed into a river, wow, was this a lot different than sagebrush. And that's something you want to remember as we go forward. Turning back to the trail, I was met with sagebrush and the kind of path that somebody who never goes in the great outdoors is not going to be able to find easily. How old is that path? Well, sadly, I can't say. There is no record of the trails, or lack thereof, when the region was first explored in modern times. Now this is rattlesnake country, so if you do visit here, bring a snake bite kit. And as you walk along the flat stretches of ground, the basalt that makes up the bedrock, it's pretty stable and you don't really feel like it shifts under you at all. But as soon as you hit any of the portions that start to go uphill, you see rubble everywhere. and the footing does become a lot more difficult. After the floods and another 12,000 years of life happening, the sides of the canyon have shed even more piles of rock, ranging in size from small pebbles to boulders too large for me to even think about moving. In fact, there's places where it's hard to hike because the rocks underfoot shift so erratically that you slip and fall a lot. Now, we see this sort of thing on a smaller scale all over the Pacific Northwest, especially in the inland northwest of Washington State. For instance, Riverside State Park, right here in Spokane, has Bullen Pitcher, a bunch of basalt formations that pop up out of the river and offer vantage points and look like they've been carved by water, and where people regularly walk, the basalt is collapsing in piles of rubble. But it's far different in the coulees, where there's piles of basalt rubble everywhere, and there hasn't been many human hands on 99.9% of the area for at least a few thousand years, more likely 10,000 years, besides the occasional person walking through. Now, these caves aren't caves in the traditional sense, much to my son's frustration. They're really just kind of holes in the wall or divots or little corkscrew kind of things that were made from the flood waters, doing all kinds of goofy stuff with vortices and whirlpools and all the above my pay grade geology things. But anyway, what's interesting about this is it does show that it was pretty tumultuous, that the whole floodwaters that came through, big surprise there, but it is still interesting. It does give some insight into just how crazy it was, because in one place the flood was doing this, and the other place it was doing that, so that is kind of goofy. But there's a lot of speculation as to what the caves were actually used for. Locals claim that there were a lot of artifacts found there, like pounding stones and other food processing things. And that would make a lot of sense. I mean, the caves are a good 10 degrees cooler than the surrounding region, and they face away from the sunrise. So you're looking at the river basically all day long, and it wouldn't be difficult to, back in the corner of the cave, to tuck your roots that you're trying to dry in a certain type of environment. You don't want them to get sunburnt, but you want them to dry in a cool, dry place. That's a great place for it back there. Great place to stash your kids while you process food or something like that if you have to. It's high up, so you can see around, and so maybe it was used to like spot game or something like that. Maybe it was a defensive position. At any rate, you're not going to farm the land, right? But it is possible that it was used for a number of different things, and they are looking into that. Well, they have looked into that a little bit. They're not looking into it right now, but don't get all angry at them. Jimmy, I'm going to have to ask you to sit down on this one, buddy. It's not the archaeologists' fault this time that they haven't done excavations, and we'll cover that here in a minute. Some archaeologists believe the caves were used during the herb gathering and fishing seasons and then abandoned the rest of the year. Other archaeologists believe there was a long-standing rivalry between the Salish and the Sahuapitan-speaking people in the region, which would make defensive positions even more helpful. Now, a lot of the information that we would use to interpret what may have gone on in these caves comes from what little we know about the mesas, because what archaeology they have done on the mesas does kind of inform us of how they might have been used. And there's still some number of hypotheses depending on the mesa, but some of them they think, you know, these caves some guys think might have been just like a site for vision quests and that kind of crap. And other guys think that it might have been like a place to spot game from or defensive positions like I mentioned earlier. There's a number of hypotheses about the region, and sadly we probably won't ever know for sure. Now in Washington State, archaeology is divided into six periods. First is the Paleo-Indian, or the Clovis period, which is from 12,000 to 10,500 years ago. This is a period that's well known to most alternate historians. It's the time of the Cordellian Ice Sheet and the Bering Land Bridge and Clovis Points and big game running across the region and all that crap, right? And after that, we have the Windust phase, from 10,500 to 8,200 years ago. Now, it's called this because of the Windust Point that's associated with the area in this time. What little we can discern from this period indicates the people had started to use more resources, collect smaller foodstuffs, and had begun settling for short periods of time as opposed to just chasing game. After this is the Vantage Phase, a phase named for the stone tools recovered from the cave near the town of Vantage on the Columbia River. Covering a period from 8,200 to 5,200 years ago, this phase is noteworthy for the clear indicators of large-scale collection of salmon and other fish. Artifacts associated with fishing show up very frequently in these sites. After that, we have the Frenchman Springs phase, from 5,200 to 2,800 years ago. This period is known for the first glyphs painted onto or carved into rocks, and the first evidence for semi-underground dwellings in the region. This half cellar, half house design may have come along due to another defining feature of this period, which is the increase in the use of roots, tubers, and berries from previous phases. This was followed by the Cayuse phase. No, the Cayuse phase. There we go. Now, this phase covers the period from 2800 to 250 years ago. It is known for several different changes, most notably larger sites, considerably larger sites, made for long-term habitation, and even more advancements in their basic stone tools. The sites were closer together as well, indicating a far more tight-knit social structure where resources were most likely traded or shared regularly amongst their immediate neighbors, something that was new in the record. As a matter of fact, the concept of people being part of the same kinfolk or tribe may have extended quite a bit over the actual physical size of the territory where people from more far-flung regions still considered themselves associated with each other. And this period finally gave way when the first Europeans arrived in the region about 250 years ago, in a period known as the Ethnohistoric Period, which continues to this day. As I mentioned, the Lenoir Caves have not been excavated, but in the region, the mesas have been. Now, they haven't done a very great job with these, but they have looked into this a little bit, and it does offer us the best archaeology we're going to find in this area, especially for a highland area. And when you look into this, you'll see that they've done a lot of archaeology like 50 years ago, and the artifacts, basically everything that they found on these mesas, has kind of just been documented and just kind of shoved away and waited for. Every now and again, it looks like a student will come out and do their doctoral thesis on one of these here mesas. And, that's very helpful. But there's a lot of information that we can garner from that we could potentially extrapolate to the caves. For example, the foods found on top of the mesa and those found near the base were almost identical in makeup, meaning there was probably very little social stratification in these societies. Now, the majority of foods were longhorn sheep and mountain goats, with fish and turtles from a nearby lake being present in large quantities as well. The mesa was certainly occupied for long periods of time, meaning it was most likely not a holy site of some sort. Most likely it was settled and used. Only one way up or down the mesa was curated by the inhabitants. They seem to have deliberately channeled all traffic into this one area for moving up or down the massive rock. Foodstuffs were certainly stored here, and some foods were processed here, but there's not a ton of evidence of the processing, suggesting that it may have been frequently done off-site, which would make sense. These hills are not easy to climb, so eliminating as much dead weight as you possibly could and get rid of the husks, you got more room for seeds, right? And then there's a time period of the mesa. It's almost purely a Cayuse site from what archaeologists can gather. It looks to have been occupied from about 2,000 years ago till about 500 years ago. The carbon dates and lithic specimens, that is, stone tools, converge on this. It seems that archaeological site 45GR144, which most of the archaeologists would just call Mesa Number 12 for short, only had humans occupying it for about 1,500 years or so. And this leads me to the point that the archaeologists are going to be happy with me on. I come from a generation when we picked arrowheads up and we put them in a shoebox and we just kept them, right? And I had a handful when I was a kid. My sister still has a nice one that she found. And the thing is it seems kind of stupid and kind of frustrating to a layperson to have somebody tell them you can't pick up this arrowhead that you found because it's freaking cool, man. You're like walking through the woods and you find this thing, and you're like, holy crap, check it out. But here's the deal. This site right here, all of the artifacts were taken before anybody that was a sciencey person or had any intention of documenting the crap at all was on the site. So we have rumors of pounding stones. We have whispers of lithic specimens there, but we don't know. We have no clue. And here's the really big deal. Remember when I named off all the different six different periods? Do you remember that second one was the Windust period? The first one's the Clovis period. They detect the difference by the type of point, the type of arrowhead they use. Now, obviously, it's not a Clovis site. I mean, the Clovis were supposedly not around after the flood, but if it was a Windust point, that would say there were people there right after the last of the great big floods or the great flood or however you want to look at that whole thing. We'll discuss the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis and the number of floods and all the geological arguments and stuff in a future video. But for now, my point is this would offer some serious insight. Did people show up and start checking out this region right after the flood? Did people not live there for another 2,000 years, 5,000 years, 10,000 years? We could tell if we had the artifacts. We would have some idea, but we don't. All we have now are a bunch of knockdown rocks, a bunch of freaking diaper that's up on the top of one of these trails that made me wonder, how'd you get your kid up there, man? How'd that work out? All this stuff that has really... there's no way that there's going to be any archaeology done at this site now. There's the occasional bit of graffiti here. They say that they're supposed to be petroglyphs. I see that on Google, but I didn't see any when I was there, and I don't see any on Google Images. So I'm wondering, maybe somebody just chipped off a chunk of basalt that had those on there, because it's not hard to knock off the wall, man. You could easily spend an afternoon and widen out one of these caves by a few feet, and I would not be at all surprised if that's happened 20 or 30 times in the last 50, 70 years. And that's really the issue. Not the people widening out the caves. I mean, that sucks. But the issue is the fact that these things were looted, basically. Not looted. The guy didn't come in and was like, I'm going to steal this shit. He's just a dude walking around exploring the area, and he finds some cool stuff, right? The people find some cool arrowheads and stuff, and they take it home, and they think it was fun. And there's no one ringing that bell. But it's something that we should be very aware of. If you're on a site and you see something like some arrowhead, some lithic specimen, anything that an archaeologist might be interested in, picking it up and putting it in your pocket does immense damage to what we could know. Think about this for a second. The guy that picked up all that crap off of there to begin with, whoever found all that stuff and put it in their shoebox or whatever, their kids passed it down. It's either in a shoebox still in the region or sold to somebody on eBay. At any rate, it's probably mingled with all other kinds of shit, and we have no clue where anything came from. So what kind of points came from that area? When was this made? We don't know. And there's so many people that come and visit the sites now, and no archaeology has been done. There is extremely small chance of us ever finding anything that's going to tell us anything. It's been taken from us. So please keep that in mind when you go visiting places in the future. And this is exceptionally sad, to be honest with you, because these things do tell a story that anybody interested in the extinctions at the end of the last ice age would love to hear. And the more history that we could pin down on these unimpressive little caves, the better our understanding of this would be. Most of you are no doubt aware that the preferred mainstream hypothesis for why animals went extinct in such large numbers at the end of the Younger Dryas right here in North America is humans overhunting them. We came across that land bridge from Asia, Clovis point in hand, and we just went around whacking everything bigger than a coyote. Bam! Now, on a serious note, though, the human hunting certainly did have some impact on the populations of these animals, but the channeled scab lands, specifically those hanging valleys that I pointed out, they offer us a pretty good bit of insight into what may have had, what almost certainly had, considerably bigger impact than any number of Clovis points. Remember when I told you that these hanging valleys are from old tributaries flowing into the riverbed before it flooded? Then the river cut the ground down so that these kind of became waterfalls? Well, imagine every one of these valleys pouring water into the lake below, connecting it to other lakes in the region, and then it becoming a river. And all of those valleys are the tributaries feeding that river. This was a far more wet, far greener, far more alive climate than it is today. And back in those days, you were supposed to have had bison running around, like I said earlier, and the short-faced bears and this giant sloths. They're eating stuff off the top of trees that we don't have, and bison eating sagebrush. So those guys are gone, and then the short-faced burying around. You see the problem. It seems to me the environment has a lot more to do with why the extinctions happened than humans overhunting them. I mean, the place is no longer conducive to these animals living there. Every one of those valleys used to be a tributary feeding into this river that's now a small lake, and those are no longer tributaries. Not a small lake, but it's small by comparison. The area has lost a ton of water from those days. And now all the water, the rain, gets locked up on the mountains and doesn't come over. So this region is basically a desert. And the caves offer real evidence of just how harsh the terrain is now. A small outcrop of rock is welcome shelter from the unrelenting sun. The indigenous people of long ago almost certainly would have used these caves, as local tradition maintains. The only good place to dry roots out of the sun for miles. Secure, with numerous great vantage points overlooking the entire canyon, and a source of water with fish nearby, these caves were probably employed thousands of times over the years. But without more information, we can never really know. I believe that the environment changing is a far more reasonable explanation for why the megafauna went extinct, and that's why I think this site would be exceptionally interesting if we actually had some artifacts. Because if we've had some artifacts from the Windust period, which would be like right after this floods, the last of the floods, or however you want to look at it, that would tell us that they moved into those caves right after the shit went down and started utilizing them immediately, and would give us some insights to what people were up to at that point. But we will never know what was going on then unless the person that happened to take them took painstaking records and their kids happened to have them. But I don't see that one popping up anytime soon. So this area, honestly, is extremely tantalizing to me because, I mean, walking through there, you just know. You look at some of these trails and some of these areas and you just know, not that you're not the first person there, but you just know this is the kind of place that if you were living off of the land, this would be the kind of place you would be like, oh, fuck yeah, I'm going to hang out here, especially when you're in that, oh, my God, my son couldn't quit complaining about the heat. And then you go to the outhouse and you're like, oh. Now, as sad as it is that the Lake Lenoir Caves are just a tourist site now and, you know, a place that people go to hang out with their kids and change their diapers or use a stinky bathroom or whatever, it does still offer a little bit of insight into the region, and it's the kind of thing that you don't really see other places. And I, you know, as a local, I get a lot of I'm privy to a little bit of this crap. My son's grandpa loaned me this here book. It's got a lot of different local information and stuff. And there's also, you just talk to people and they have like, they just tell you things, right? And so I'm going to talk about a few other areas in the Channeled Scab Lands and in Washington State that might be of interest to the alternate historian and all that crap as time goes on, because there is a lot of interesting stuff here that just kind of gets, you know, passed up because everybody's looking at the really impressive major things. But the little things like this, in my opinion, they kind of help flesh out everything. Thanks a lot for watching this far. Special thanks to my patrons, and I hope this was enjoyable to all of you, and we'll see you next time.